parenting doesn't come with a manual, and when your child learns differently, there's no one-size-fits-all. Here, we think out the box. We celebrate every unique mind, every different path, and every win, big or small. Welcome to Out the Box, where kids and parents grow together.
Good morning and welcome to Out the Box, for minds that don't fit the mold and hearts that keep striving. I'm Simone Herring, mom, teacher, literacy and dyslexia therapist, and I'm so glad you've joined us today on Chai FM 101.9. This is the space where we talk about children who sometimes feel like they don't quite fit the system. Children who are trying, children who are capable, children who are working incredibly hard but still struggling. Today, we're talking about something far less understood than dyslexia, dyscalculia. Now, many people know what dyslexia is, but when it comes to maths, children who struggle are often described as not a maths person, careless, lazy, not trying hard enough. But sometimes the issue is not effort. Sometimes the brain simply processes numbers differently. For some children, mathematics unfolds logically. There are patterns, and patterns build on patterns. There are concepts that connect. But for others, numbers feel abstract, confusing, and overwhelming. Today we're asking, what exactly is dyscalculia? Why does it happen? What does it feel like for a child? And most importantly, how can we help? Before we get stuck into what dyscalculia is, it's time for the word of the week, because vocabulary is one of the keys that unlock learning. Today's word is numeracy. Numeracy means understanding and working with numbers in everyday life. Things like telling the time, handling money, or estimating quantities. Try using the word today and ask your children, where do we use numeracy in our daily lives? I'm so excited to say that every month we will be joined by a teacher or therapist from Bella Vista School, sharing their knowledge and experience about barriers to learning and how we can teach and support your children better. And today we have Annelise Clark-Hendry, who is an occupational therapist, teacher, and HOD of Professional Awards at Bella Vista Share. Annelise, welcome to Out the Box.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I was so thrilled after we had spoken at the Bella Vista conference because I've got so much to ask you and speak about. So I'm going to get stuck in. Annelise, many people assume that if a child struggles with maths, it simply means they're not a maths person. Is dyscalculia just being bad at maths, or is it something fundamentally different?
Yes, I think it's quite a big question, and I think many of our questions are going to be big questions today, but it is a brain difference. So somebody can be bad at maths because they weren't taught properly, or they were distracted when they were little, or they didn't play well enough when they were little, you know, physically with concrete toys. But then that fundamental dyscalculia is really those children that it's more than that. It's that intuitive sense of muchness and of number in itself. So if you can think about it as having an internal number line. So we all, if you can visualize, close your eyes and see a number line in your head, you can see number one all the way to 15 or 20 or 30. You know the order of the numbers, and you know that what comes before and after. But a person with dyscalculia often struggles to understand, say, the distance between 1 and 5 compared to the distance between 1 and 50. For a start, the 5 doesn't necessarily carry a completely different meaning to the number 50, just because they don't understand that quantity or the muchness of each number. So it's quite an intuitive disability, more than just being bad at maths.
It often happens that children are labeled and, you know, that they go through life as I did. I told a story this morning about when I was in Standard 2, well, Grade 4, it was a long time ago, and I was expected to say my times tables very quickly. And we had to stand in a row and put our hands out in front of us. And if we did not answer the times table fast enough, we used to get hit on our knuckles. And I used to get hit on my knuckles regularly. And I developed this block to maths from then, which I still have today. And I often ask myself, should I actually come to you and do a diagnostic test? Am I dyscalculic? Or do I have a block to maths?
Yeah, most probably not dyscalculic, but more an absolute trauma to maths. And, when we experience a trauma, we go into that fight and flight mode. And you almost, every time you then are associated with maths and maths problems, you go into the flight mode and off you go. Your brain is not going to go there because you've been so traumatized. And I think something just on that exact topic of knowing timetables and memorization, we have to realize that you don't have to be dyscalculic or dyslexic to have memory difficulties. So if you are not able to remember your times tables, it might just be that maybe there was a bit of ADHD or something in there where you had a memory difficulty. It didn't mean you couldn't do maths. I know a lot of children that is slow learners. They are slow learners, but they can't do their times tables, but they are exceptionally deep thinkers and they are exceptional in maths if you give them the time, but they don't know their timetables, you know, at the top of their head.
And for me, exactly what you're saying, it's about time. I think if we give time to children to think, it just takes away a lot of that anxiety. Just give them a space to process. And as you said, you know, do the sum in their working memory and then produce the answer.
Yes. And I think if I can just add to that, you know, I'm sure we'll get more deeper into lessons and how we teach, but the teachers are trying to get through a curriculum that rushes the children to think faster than what they should or can. And that's actually quite detrimental to them. And in the same breath, we take away all their concrete apparatus and then wonder why they struggle with the abstract concepts like just remembering times tables.
That was something that I was thinking about earlier. Why are we forcing children to move so quickly from concrete to abstract? And can they not continue their maths education, even into high school, using the concrete? Why are we rushing?
It's become a culture, which is quite sad, because one of my greatest people that I follow is a doctor called Mahesh Sharma. And he says that even in adults, if you learn a new concept, you always start concretely. You can't start abstractly, no matter what new concept you are learning. So always start concretely, even at least representationally, which means like as a drawing or a visual representation of a algebraic sum or whatever it could be. You can do it in shapes and forms. But to just start abstractly already overwhelms the brain, and it is not possible to always process all the procedures that comes after that.
Well, it's so true to what you say, because maths is seeing and feeling. So seeing it and actually feeling and manipulating objects to help you. I mean, the abacus was used for many, many years and years. I don't know what you think about the abacus today. But to actually feel the maths in your hands.
Yes.
Is dyscalculia as common as dyslexia is? You know, we know that one in five children could be dyslexic. Does dyscalculia?
Yes. So dyscalculia is not nearly as common, but it may very well be because of what we call the research gap. So for every 14 research papers on dyslexia, we have one in dyscalculia. So what we know about dyslexia is a lot more than what we know about dyscalculia, and therefore the diagnosis aren't actually happening. So,
Annalise, I hate to interrupt anybody, but I have to do these ad things. Please hold on to your thought if you can. Sometimes the greatest relief for a parent is simply hearing something someone else say. That happens in our home too.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
If you've ever wondered why maths feels so much harder for your child than it seems to be for others, send us a message. WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. We're speaking to Annalise Clark-Hendry from Bella Vista School about dyscalculia. Annalise, if we go back to what we were talking about, dyslexia seeming to be so much more common than dyscalculia, can you continue what you were saying?
Well, first of all, what we need to remember is that dyscalculia and dyslexia is what we call a specific learning difficulty or disability, along with dysgraphia. So all three of them are classified as specific learning disabilities. So in a way, they should all present almost equally, but they don't because of the lack of research that is still being done with dyscalculia compared to dyslexia. And I think dysgraphia is even further behind. But dyscalculia, because it's also such an innate difficulty with number processing, they say there's only about 5 to 7% currently of people that has it. However, you can also have a normal general maths difficulty or maths delay. So it's very difficult to distinguish between the two. But the point for us is always, if you have the difficulty, you need the help, regardless of you have the actual diagnosis. And then it's also important, to remember that they work together, these difficulties. So there's about a 40 to 50% overlap of children that have dyslexia, or that children that have dyscalculia may also have dyslexia, as well as ADHD. So you can always see bits of the different learning difficulties in each of the different diagnoses, which also makes it difficult to make the actual diagnosis.
So in my case, I have, as you know, two boys who are profoundly dyslexic. And as I say, I have this block. Is it genetic?
It is. It is definitely genetic. It doesn't have to be, but that's always the first thing we can look at, because it's an easy indicator that if mom or dad struggled in any kind of learning difficulty, even when it was with ADHD, so anything that's neurodevelopmental, then your children are more likely to have a neurodevelopmental difficulty. So you being dyslexic may, or dyscalculic if you were, may have resulted in dyscalculia or dyslexia or ADHD in your children. So it doesn't have to be an immediate transition of one specific thing, but anything that's neurodevelopmental can get transferred down generations, yes.
So let me just clarify, when you say it's neurodevelopmental or it's innate, we know that with dyslexia, our brains are not wired to learn to read. That's a man-made concept, yes. And we have to actually create new neural pathways in our brain to learn to read. Is it the same for dyscalculia? Is it the same for maths? Are we born with the ability to do maths?
It is almost the same, but not quite. So if we look at reading, language that is part of reading, or an important part of reading, that's innate. That comes with us and that we are born with. And then we use that language and we map it onto symbols. For maths, it's very similar where we are born with an innate sense of quantity, not necessarily direct numbers. But if a lion is, there's two lions, they are going to not go for a whole giraffe or a whole hippo by themselves. They'd rather be six lions. So all mammals have this sense of quantity. They know what's too much or too little. And as when we are born, we have that. But what we as humans then can do, which is then not natural, is to map the quantity to a symbol. So it's almost the same as with literacy. But then those people with dyscalculia really struggles with that innate sense of number.
I understand. That makes sense. It does. Annelise, I have a WhatsApp, and I always do like to read them out because I think it's parents struggling and children struggling, and with you here as a professional to answer it is just wonderful. It says, "Hi, my daughter is in grade 5 and she still counts on her fingers for almost everything in maths. Her teacher says she should have moved past that by now. Should I be worried?" Annelise?
Okay, so it's an interesting question, and I think there's quite a few layers to this. The first is that our fingers are very important for maths calculations, and we should never try to get kids to take away their hands. And there's all this research that's been done about finger perception. Knowing your fingers well will result often in better maths processing, because the part, it's called the somatosensory cortex in the brain that is responsible for finger perception, actually gets activated when you do maths calculations, whether or not you use your fingers. So it is very closely related. So a child using their fingers, it's almost just a concrete tool that they're using to work out their numbers. However, this child's already in grade 5, and even though using fingers is not a bad thing, she should also be able to visualize muchness. So she should be able to visualize what 10 looks like, what 5 looks like in a pattern that was sort of established earlier on in her maths journey. And what she's doing is she's still relying a lot on counting instead of relying on visualization to put numbers together and take them apart, which means all her calculations and all her work is most probably going to be much slower than her peers. So yes, there is a bit of concern in it. It's not the whole idea of just using the fingers that's the concern, but the reason why she's using her fingers is that she's counting and not visualizing quantities in bulk.
And is that why bonds are so important?
Yes, definitely. So bonds is very important, but also patterns. So if you look at the patterns in a dice and you look at the number 5 dice and you have another number 5, you immediately know that's 10 because of the pattern that your brain has recognized. And then you know if you've got one less dot than that, there's going to be 9. So it's almost that thing that where you have to know it and not have to start from scratch and count all the dots until you get to 9.
Right.
That makes sense.
I have another WhatsApp here. Do Montessori preschool children have as many issues with numbers since Montessori teaching allows children touch? What are they counting? I mean, let me just see that again. Sorry. Since Montessori teaching allows children to touch what they are counting.
That's an interesting question. I think it's not as much about the curriculum or the approach that the teachers use. I think it is about touching, and there's many other approaches or preschool teachers that allow for touching when they're counting. As long as whatever gets taught, the absolute foundations of maths gets taught. So counting is one part of a foundation, and there's like 5 or 6 or 7 different foundations. So visualization is also a foundation of maths. If we can't visualize, like I explained with our previous WhatsApp, then we can't move on from counting. And quantity is also an expression of, on the playground of math. So if my bucket is halfway full of sand and my friend's bucket is three quarters full of sand, they might not know half and three quarters, but they know who's got the most sand. So I think it really depends on the actual teacher or the approach on the playground more than a curriculum, you know, or a specific approach to teaching.
Right. I had to phonetically extend this word for myself because I couldn't say it. It's subitizing. Is that correct? What is subitizing, and why is it important? You know, why is the automatic gut feeling for numbers often missing for someone with dyscalculia?
So subitizing, we can call it subitizing or subitizing. It doesn't really matter. It depends if you're American or British.
Well, chat gave me subitizing, so.
And that is just the ability to, when you see an amount of anything. So if you are looking at your desk now and there's three pencils on your desk, you don't have to go and count one, two, three. There's now three. You can see it and you know automatically that there is three. So that innate sense of number comes forth in your understanding of quantity. And a lot of times people with dyscalculia does not have it. And even as adults, they will still count the one, two, three, which makes any maths daily task an absolute slow nightmare because everything they do, they count. It's an easy way also to understand or know if children have that innate sense of quantity. We can go up to about five as an adult. We can't really see above that or beyond five. If we have six or seven dots and we look at it very quickly, then we start estimating. But we will be able to see five dots when it's flashed to us. We'll be able to see five dots, and then children, anything from three, four, when they see it, they'll know how much it is.
So it's very similar to the kind of automaticity that you want to create in teaching children to learn, the automaticity of recognizing words, etc. And so Is this recognizing quantities also or should be an automatic skill that the child needs to learn?
Yes, it definitely should. But it goes a bit further than that, where then also to a point of automaticity, they would need to understand that the four dots that I saw and immediately could recognize is more than the three dots that I saw. So we get to what we call magnitude comparison. So we need to be able to compare quantities and know which one is more and which one is less. But then on top of that, also have the language for that, more, less, bigger, smaller. So there's a lot involved in understanding quantity and understanding that subitizing.
Okay, subitizing, Annelies. I'm going with subitizing.
I'll
have to practice the other one. So for many parents listening today who may be wondering about their child, what are the key red flags of dyscalculia?
I think the biggest one is that magnitude comparison. Really struggling to understand that 4 is bigger than 3, or on the number line, see that 4 comes after 3. 3 is 1 plus 2, you know. So it is to have an idea of quantity, what is bigger, what is smaller. That is sometimes really difficult for children to grasp. So that is the first red flag. The other one is being able to sequence. So if you say, get out your books and we're going to go to page 5 and we're going to get our scissors out. By the time you get to scissors, they have already almost run away because they can't remember what you've asked them. So any sequence, because if you think about it in maths, everything happens in a sequence or in a pattern. Numbers happen in a pattern. It happens in a sequence. Shapes happens in patterns and sequences. So when a young child struggles with sequencing, that's also a bit of a red flag. And then the other big thing for young children is that body perception of where they are in space, as well as laterality. So what is their left and their right? That is a really big indicator. If they struggle with left to right, or right to left, or what is my left side? What is my right side? What's your left side? What's your right side? Those are all markers of risk or of red flags. But when the kids are older, we can see it in that automaticity that we were talking about. So automaticity of bonds of 10, understanding how those are put together, understanding that the number system is based on 10.
Mm.
And it's actually so beautiful because our body is based on 10. We've got 10 fingers and 10 toes. So if we don't have that body perception, then it doesn't cross over to understanding of base of 10. And then even older kids telling time and following directions is a big red flag as well. Following directions and instructions.
Right. And when we speak about the bonds and you ask the child, you know, 6 and 4, would a child struggling with math concepts go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then the 4, 7, 8, 9, 10? Without,
yes, and they would, or they would not maybe even get to counting the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They would actually need to see it concretely. I think often not even the fingers help sometimes. It's really just to, they don't have that understanding of the muchness of 6 and the muchness of 4. Never mind that they make the 10, which is our base. Yeah.
So when teaching bonds, the best thing is to use the concrete so that they can
absolutely
see it. Yeah.
Many times over and over and over until they can get.
Right. Annelise, I've got another one here. It says, "Hi, Simon. My child is really struggling with maths, and homework often ends in tears. He keeps saying the numbers don't make sense to him. Could this possibly be dyscalculia?"
It's a very difficult question because there's obviously, again, a lot of layers to this. Because if the maths doesn't make sense to him, is it because he's overwhelmed or is it because he really struggles to understand what is being asked? And if it is because he struggles to understand what is being asked, then yes, we look towards the dyscalculia side. But if it is because he's overwhelmed, I think the first thing to do is just to acknowledge with him, you are having a hard time, and then we can delve into the big world of maths anxiety, which often masks, it looks like dyscalculia, it masks what they are able to do. And I think that's what you were referring to for yourself when
yes,
you were younger, where just the brain just flees and it just can't participate. So in this case, I would have a deeper look at previous years, how he did in maths and at the younger years, what his approach was, what is his parents' approach? Is there anybody in the house or at school that says, "Oh, I'm not a maths person. I can't do maths. Maths is so hard." Because all of those cultural background creates a picture for the child. And once they sort of hit a block, it's very difficult to get out of it.
So in the WhatsApp, she doesn't tell us how old the child is. But my question is, what age can we diagnose dyscalculia?
So I think with any learning difficulty, we've always had this idea in our heads that we must wait until the child is 9 or grade 3. And it was never really written anywhere. But dyscalculia, dyslexia, and dysgraphia, all of these have early indicators, like we were talking about those early red flags. And so your diagnosis doesn't have to wait till later, although some people feel it must. But I think the most important is to identify there's a difficulty and then work immediately. So let's not jump, let's not wait before we jump in and help. Let's start helping as early as possible because the brain is more plastic. There's a lot more pathways that can be formed than when we wait until some people only get diagnosed when they're teenagers, when they need their concessions for high school. And then trying to then intervene is almost like, very hard because the pathways are formed. I mean, it's never impossible, but working with the younger learners is a lot more possible. So we rather look at, are we having a difficulty? Let's jump in straight away, and the diagnosis itself can come along the way.
Okay, so if you're listening this morning and this sounds familiar in your home, we'd really love to hear from you, share your experience, or ask a question.
Connecting our community from Johannesburg to each of us is on life's journey. Thank you for letting Chai FM provide the soundtrack to your life. Chai FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking to Annelise Clark-Henry about dyslexia. Annelise, is the intervention similar to the type of intervention we have with dyslexia? You know, when we speak about early intervention, dyslexia has a systematic, focused, multisensory, and deliberate intervention. How can intervention help learners with dyscalculia? And is it as focused and deliberate as the dyslexia type of intervention?
It's definitely very similar because it's a learning difficulty. We almost tackle it the same way. Although dyslexia is quite linear, so we have phonemes that makes words, words make sentences, sentences make paragraphs, and so on. Maths is built on foundations, so we're moving upwards. So we're moving from those basic body concepts all the way upwards. And so maths intervention often looks a lot simpler and a lot more concrete because we need to get the foundations in even for adults. If you don't have the foundations, your understanding of maths is going to completely collapse. So yes, we do do structured sessions, multisensory, always starting with concrete. And we focus on that basic number sense. So we focus on sequencing, visualization, pattern recognition. That base 10 and bonds to 10 is one of the main things that you may have to focus on for weeks and weeks until you get it. And then we always create an opportunity for what we call overlearning, meaning a lot of repetition, because that any child with a learning difficulty needs a huge amount of repetitions in different ways and different approaches to be able to consolidate the concepts that they are being taught.
When I was doing research for the show, I found that dyscalculia and significant maths anxiety can go together or be Yes. separate from one another. What are some of the classroom factors that can contribute to that anxiety?
The biggest
Besides being hit factor. On your knuckles.
Yes. But I think the biggest classroom factor is the teacher. And I can use myself as an example. And I sometimes still really want to hit myself over the knuckles for the stuff that I said. I was teaching a grade two class for many years. And the thing I always used to say to them is, come, let's get out our maths. And we start doing the maths. And then I'll go, actually, I can't do it this far. I can only do grade two maths. And the culture that I left for those kids is that maths is hard. Mm. And yes, in myself, my mindset was incorrect. And my mindset was, and I still feel like I struggle with maths, but I created a class mindset of maths is hard. Mm. So if we can create a mindset, that's the first thing in the classrooms, that maths is a mindset, it's achievable, and anyone can do maths. There is no such thing as a maths brain. And it has been clinically proven that there is no such thing as a maths brain. So we need to portray that message to the children, but also to the parents, because often parents are is the second thing where they would say, I was never good at math, so, you know, don't bother.
I'm guilty. Because I'm guilty.
You're not going. Exactly. So I think if we can create a positive mindset and then start working on any answer is acceptable. It doesn't mean every answer is correct, because math is very much that right and wrong culture. Any answer is acceptable, and then it is challengeable. So when we have an answer in the class and every child must be confident to give an answer, even if it's incorrect, and then another peer will be able to say, can I challenge that because I think A, B, and C? And when it becomes a discussion in the class, like literacy would or any geography lesson would, then it becomes a fun and engaging subject rather than, yes, I've got it wrong, or no, I'm so bad at it because I did it, I got it wrong. Yes, I got it right, or yes, I got it, or no, I got it wrong. Yeah, I'm getting my yeses and nos mixed up.
I just want to move to high school and then perhaps go back. But this is a question that that's been burning me, and I've just actually received a WhatsApp about it. The WhatsApp mentioned Mukundi. Have you got it over there? Thank you. It's not here. It was about a grade 11 child who was struggling with maths. My granddaughter is in grade 11 and has been told to drop maths and only do math literacy. I think she had no grounding during the COVID time by doing school online. And that's from Carol. Thank you, Carol, because that takes me into the conversation of high school and the stigma that maths literacy is lower than core maths. And I know children who have taken core maths and done well, not distinctions, but they've done well. And then they've taken maths literacy as the project. You know about this project that you can do. And yes, and they have excelled, distinctions. Please unpack the difference between core maths and maths literacy, and help these parents and the children out there to realize that maths literacy is not easier. It's different.
Yes. So core maths is amazing in terms of those children or students that want to develop in that direction. So if you want to become a scientist, an engineer, and that is your way of thinking and your way of doing, then absolutely it is the way you should be going. It grows your brain. It challenges you. It's very abstract. But that's what you're going to need, and that's the way you're functioning and thinking. So I think it's an amazing thing. And I think core maths teachers are incredible. But yeah. Maths, I always say that maths lit, if I do core maths and I have a best friend doing maths lit, my maths lit friend is going to do my taxes one day, because you don't learn that basic, well, it's not even basic, the normal life skills that we need to learn when we are adults. 100%. So if I'm going to become the remedial teacher that I am, I'm going to take maths lit because I need to work out my interest rate on investments that I'm putting in. I need to work out my own tax. I'm not going to pay someone to do my tax. I need to work out, I need to go to the tile shop and I want to tile my house. I need to work out the square meterage of my house. And those are very important life skills that we need that requires maths. But I'm not going to need some algebraic equation because I'm a remedial teacher for foundation-based children. So yes. I think we need to realize that we need to go in the direction where we are wanting to head in future. We do not have to do all these incredible core maths, abstract concepts, if that's not what we need, unless we want to grow our brain by doing it, for fun, because some people do study maths for fun. But for children that struggle, maths lit is not an easy way out. It is just a different approach. It's a language-based approach. It's a practical approach to what they will need in life. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's not a standard grade maths. It's a completely different subject.
Exactly. And I've got to come and talk to you because if I go out with friends and we go out for a meal, and I'll say, okay, I'm going to treat you, I'll pay for the meal, but can you please work out the tip? Because I suddenly freeze and I get so anxious that am I going to be able to work out this tip and will it be correct? And but maths literacy would have helped me with that. Budgets, taxes, interest, measurements, graphs, maps, data. I mean,
Yes.
telling the time and working out time differences. Why do children with dyscalculia struggle with time, with telling the time?
Time is such an abstract concept. And like we've said, abstract concepts are just, it's just very difficult for people with dyscalculia. So time is one of them, and organization is another one. It really is just difficult. It's got fractions involved if you think about it. It's got 60 within 1 minute. It's
12-hour
just a lot.
clock, 24-hour clock.
Exactly.
Annelise, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us to understand dyscalculia. We didn't get through most of what we wanted to get through, which always happens to me. But we understand the barrier to learning, and we now understand that we have to teach in a way that makes learning possible. I always end with a quote. Professor Brian Butterworth, one of the leading researchers in this field, describes dyscalculia very simply. He says, dyscalculia is to maths what dyslexia is to reading. Yet, despite being just as common, it is far less understood. If something spoke to you about the dis if something in the discussion we were having today resonated with you, sounded familiar to you, share it. If there's one thing I've learned on this journey is that your stories and your experiences help other parents and children. If you missed the show, you can go and listen to the podcast on Chai FM's website, and there are also the previous 8 podcasts that we have done. So don't miss out and go and listen. I'm Simone Herring. And I'll be back with you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Chai FM 101.9. Annelise, I don't even have time to ask you to give like your one sentence of advice. So I'm going to ask you to stay on and I will post it on the Instagram,
Perfect.
etc. And please, I
Perfect.
would love you to come back because there is so much to
Of course.
unpack.
Of course. Thanks for having me.